Search the phrase doyen of Soviet history, and whether you're using Google, AI, or just reading the Journal of Foreign Affairs, the only name you'll be pointed to is our guest on The Year That Made Me today, the Australian historian and Soviet history superstar, Sheila Fitzpatrick. Sheila has written many, many volumes on Soviet history, including the shortest history of the Soviet Union. And I'm very pleased to say that Sheila joins us now on The Year That Made Me. Welcome.
Hello.
Sheila, you are a historian whose family history is fuller than usual with historians. Could you tell us a bit about the history and historians of the Fitzpatrick family?
Yeah, it's really boring to have gone into the family trade so thoroughly. My father, Brian Fitzpatrick, he started this whole thing. He wrote on Australian history, economic history, and he sort of gave a radical, rather anti-imperial slant to it and a labor-focused one. He was outside of academia. That was when he was really a human rights person, a gadfly of government. But his work was actually used in academia. So it was a curious relationship. My younger brother, David, also became a historian, although, of course, we hoped not after, I had earlier been going to be a violinist, but I sort of deviated off, and we hoped he would become a mathematician, but he ended up as a very distinguished Irish historian.
And Sheila, when you look back on your early years, what factors do you see as being, if you like, the seeds of your interest in and eventual focus on the Soviet Union?
The first thing, I think, was almost sort of happenstance. If you did an arts degree, or maybe it was just honours arts, I don't remember, at University of Melbourne, you had to have a language. And I had had French and Latin at school, didn't want to do them. I wanted to do German, but they wouldn't let me into German at the university because I didn't have school German. So, okay, I could get into Russian. So I did Russian 1. And then I thought, well, I maybe should do Russian too, because I don't know, it's no use to me, what I've learned in Russian 1. And then came my fourth year as a history honors person, and you had to write a thesis. So I thought, well, I'll write something actually that connects with the music that's going to come at the end. I thought I'll write something on Soviet music, because I was still sort of half a violinist in my mind. So my topic was whether, the Soviet Union said they had brought classical music to the people, and had they really done it? And my answer was no, although I think that was a bit hard on them, actually, looking back. But never mind. I was terribly proud of this thing, and it was a wonderful experience, my first research. And I did use some Russian sources, and I wrote off to Moscow. I later found my letter in the archive.
Yes, I was wondering, because what was it like actually doing Soviet history from Australia in, what is this, the early 1960s?
Yes, very beginning of the 1960s. Well, it was terrible, of course, because there was hardly anything. I think the State Library got Pravda, and the Russian department itself had a small library that wasn't bad. But anyway, I didn't have much. And so I wrote off to the Russians and said, I'm doing this thing on Soviet music. Can you send me some stuff? And curiously enough, they did. Mm. I find it in the archives, sort of 50 years later or so. And they said, yes, contact Professor somebody or other. And anyway, they sent me some books, but it took them so long that by that time I had to submit my thesis and it was all over. But it was nice of them to send me, I have to say. So that's really how, so there I am, I'm a history person. And in the 60s or 50s and 60s, this is what, 61, I guess. If you got first in history at University of Melbourne, then you were expected to go off to Oxford or Cambridge if you were really sort of enterprising. But I went to Oxford, very boring of me to do that. And actually, it was itself boring. But when I got my Commonwealth Scholarship, I had to say I was going to do something. In other words, I had to have a field. So I said my field is Soviet history. And that was interesting, especially when I got to Oxford, and I found that Soviet history isn't a field. Historians don't recognize anything after 1917, the revolution. And that was when I really got hooked, because I thought, this is absurd. Of course it's a field, but we just have to work out what the parameters are. So somebody's got to go in there and sort of, as it were, stake it out. And so that, I think, was, rather presumptuously, what I decided to do.
And stake it out, you did. And as you say, someone's got to go in there. It was this interest which, of course, led to your first visit to the Soviet Union. And Shilly, you've written that in 1966 you spent 3 lonely months falling in love with Moscow. I wonder if you could unravel that phrase for us a bit.
It was very difficult for me to get there. I finally got there on the British exchange. I arrived a bit late after the other ones, and my Russian was still not good. I could read okay, but I didn't speak it well, and I was very keen on not mixing with the British, because they were English speakers. But if, you know, who else am I going to mix with? So in those first 3 months, I met some people, but they were the people that the KGB sent to get to know me. And I, although I did get to know them, I didn't want to get to know them too closely. So that's why those months were lonely. But what I did, I decided I need to get to know Moscow. Now, there was one book on Moscow, on historical Moscow, Moscow, you know, changing over time. Of course, it was difficult to find, as all books were, but I managed to find this book. And so with this in my hand, I went around looking. Here used to be a church and now is something else. And here they've taken what used to be, you know, a merchant's house, and it's become something else. And there is a fascinating thing in Moscow. There is what used to be the governor's house, and they wanted to convert it to a Soviet institutional purpose. But Stalin wanted to make it more impressive. So they were moving it back from the road because they were broadening the road. But they also expanded it and added several stories. So the whole thing got kind of blown up. It's quite extraordinary. So I loved finding out things like that. That's what I was doing in those 3 months.
And so what was it about Moscow that made you fall in love?
I think the incongruities. You know, there was your Stalinist architecture, there was your old 17th century church next to it, there was your 19th century sort of merchants, Moscow. All of these were sitting together. There was the Stalinist, as it were, facade, but what was underneath was so different, and it was so disparate. It wasn't like Petersburg, which was then Leningrad, that is basically an architectural ensemble of 18th century imperial. That's what the center is. Moscow was in a certain way a mess, but that's what made it so interesting.
On The Year That Made Me, we're speaking with pioneering Soviet historian Shilly Fitzpatrick. And Shilly, as a historian, you were known controversially back in the day as a revisionist historian of the Soviet Union. So I wonder if you could give us an example of something that typified your approach as a revisionist and defined your approach in contrast to the way other Soviet history was being done.
Well, Soviet history in a sense wasn't being done. It was being done by the political scientists, and they were working with the totalitarian model. And that says everything in the Soviet Union is run from above. The only thing that matters is what they decide at the very top of the political system, what Stalin Politburo also decides. And then that instruction goes down the society and everybody does it. And that, therefore, there is by definition no sort of history of the grassroots. There's no history from below to right. But no social historian is going to accept that. And that was sort of my point of departure. I didn't know what was going on below. I just thought, in principle, it's got to be wrong that there is nothing there. And I suppose you could see my ultimate answer, but that's decades later, is in the book called Everyday Stalinism, where I'm talking about, first of all, you've got the sort of Soviet institutional structure, and that determines some aspects of everyday life. But in particular, it creates a sort of life in the interstices of the official structure. The things that aren't meant to be there, in other words, the things like patronage, very important to belong to a sort of patronage network. You needed that for survival, a friendship network as well. And what is called a blood network. I guess that word is totally unfamiliar, but it's, and if you look for a dictionary definition, it means a system of reciprocal favors. But what it means is that if I need to get my child into coaching to get into Moscow University, etc., I know somebody who can help me with that. And in return, I, who have access to God knows what, let's say I work in a government department that gives out parking permits or something. If the friend who helps me with the tutoring ever needs anything to do with parking, I owe him one. it's not I do something for you and you immediately do something for me. It's more like a running tally that exists. Anyway, that's how life operated. And it meant, of course, that if you're in the society and not in any networks, in any friendship groups or patronage or whatever, you were quite an outsider. Fortunately, by the time I arrived there in the second half of the 60s, foreigners could make friends, they could become friends with Soviet citizens, they could even become part of friendship groups. And that's what happened to me, and indeed most of the other people who were on the exchange found some friendship group that they joined.
And those informal networks of obligation that you've described, Sheila, did you understand them as something that had grown up in the Soviet Union and after the Russian Revolution, or were they actually pre-existing structures that had adapted to the new social structure?
Well, for sure, patronage was a pre-existing structure and a very important one. The reciprocal favors one, I think, probably exists to some degree before the revolution, but it developed particularly after the revolution because of the endemic shortages. It became so difficult to get things. It wasn't a question of have you got money to get things, it was can you find the things to get? And that's where having contacts everywhere became so important.
We're circling in on the year that you've chosen as the year that made you, Sheila Fitzpatrick. But before we do, I wanted to ask you about another sort of iconic year in the history of the Soviet Union, which was 1968, a couple of years after you first went to Moscow. Where were you for the events of 1968?
At the first months of the year, I was in Moscow. And that was my second visit. My first visit, I was there for 10 months, and the last 6 months or so became enormously productive academically, personally, in every way. And so I agitated to go back, and I got back for a 3-month thing. And so I'd spent 3 months working in the archives, seeing my friends, having a wonderful time. And then I went back to Oxford when the 3 months were over. And that's when the invasion in the summer of Czechoslovakia happened. And that was a big shock to me. Somehow, I don't know. I mean, after all, Hungary had happened. Why would I not expect something like that? But in any case, it was a shock to me and also to the circles I moved in Russia, in the Soviet Union. After that, my group were clustered around a reform-minded journal. It was called Novy Mir or New World. This is non-dissident, but it's in-system criticism. Definitely reform-oriented. So 68 is a big blow for everybody like that. And their journal survived, but the editorship staggered on for a couple of years, but then they got fired. So it was the writing on the wall to a degree for my friends as well as a shock for me.
And obviously it was a military crackdown in the Eastern Bloc, but was there a similar change in terms of cracking down on accessibility for someone like yourself who was trying to research Soviet history in Russia at the time?
It didn't play out like that. It was a crackdown on the reformers, but for me, the archival access didn't stop. It was limited always. I mean, they never, for one thing, in the archives, they'd never tell me what they had. They'd never let me see a catalogue. I had to imagine what they might have and ask for them, but sometimes they would help me. And indeed, they did help me. They helped me more in 68 than they had in 66, 67. But that is just because they'd got to know me. They decided on the basis of who knows what that I'm sort of for real. In other words, I'm not there as a spy, even if all historians are kind of spies. I'm really there as a historian. So they believed that. And life in the archives was okay.
We'll move on now to the year that you've chosen as the year that made you, Sheila. The first thing I wanted to ask you about that year, though, is a phrase that you actually used with Richard Feidler in one of your many conversations with Richard over the years, where you described yourself as being a different person when you speak Russian. Could you explain that a little for us?
Oh, yes, that's interesting. Well, I'm sometimes a different person when I speak Russian. By 68... my Russian had really improved. I have these friends. I talk to them, completely fluently and idiomatically, and I kind of think in Russian and I feel like a Russian. And that continued for a while. But then in the 70s and early 80s, I was going less to Russia. I mean, I still spoke Russian, but I didn't speak it in that same way that the language was my language. That started coming back along with perestroika, which was a very funny thing. I suddenly noticed. But one of the things, if you speak a language, you're not very much at home in it. In a sense, your personality comes through much less. You don't make jokes, for example. You can't ever say anything even slightly ironic. You have to be very straightforward and sort of quite bread and butter kind of speech. But so that would be what I was like when the Russian was not good. But then when it came back, I think I could be my personality was there in the Russian. And that's what happened sometime in the 80s, well, connected with perestroika, I think.
Which brings us to 1989, another signal year in the history of the Soviet Union, certainly the fall of the Berlin Wall and really the beginning of the end for the Soviet Union. And that's the year that you've chosen as the year that made you, but not just for professional reasons either, Sheila. I wonder if we could start by talking about the personal. Why was 1989 so significant for you on a personal front?
Well, it was an incredible year for me because everything changed personally and professionally at the same time and completely unpredictably. So the personal bit was that I met the person that I ultimately married, Michael Danos, a physicist. And I met him completely accidentally on a plane. This was in April. Already things were really exciting. I was just back from Moscow. I'd taken a group of American historians over to talk to Soviet historians. Everyone is very excited. And then I'd gone to this conference in Italy and I was coming back and the Italians had given me first class ticket. And I was not then in the category when that normally happened to. So I was very pleased with my first class ticket across the Atlantic. But we were late for the connection in New York to Austin. I was then living in Texas. And so I got bumped out of first class and put in a middle seat in economy. And I was not happy, as you can imagine. I'm the last person to enter the plane. I come down, middle seat, two men on either side. Oh, my God, you know. Anyway, so I won't speak to either of them. I mean, I greeted them. You know, they were both very friendly, actually. And one was Misha. One was the person I'm going to end up with. So we sit in total silence until Dallas. However, I notice that he is writing a letter in French. You know, if you're in a middle seat, you can't help seeing what somebody in the middle seat is doing. So he's writing this letter to Charles Agnès in French. So that's interesting. So I thought, well, maybe I shouldn't have snubbed him quite as much, but, oh, okay. And then we get to Dallas. The planes used to land in Dallas and then go on the final 40 minutes to Austin. Everyone else got off except me and Misha. So I have to talk to him now, right? I mean, he's trapped in his window seat. Anyway, so that's how I met Misha. And we got together incredibly quickly. One of the incredible things was at that point, I just accepted a new job at Chicago with great apprehension. I was really scared about that. And I had also accepted a fellowship in Paris for 3 months before I took that up. And I was extremely apprehensive about that. I thought, my school French, I don't know anyone there. I don't know where I'm going to live. This is all awful. So when I meet Misha, not only does he have all kinds of incredible qualities, he actually has an apartment in Paris. And so by June, we meet in April. By June, we were in that apartment in Paris. But not all the time because we were, you know, after the Soviet Union, we were traveling around. Anyway, it was quite extraordinarily exciting. And every month something new and remarkable would happen, like the Berlin Wall coming down. Yeah.
And what language did you and Misha speak to each other in?
Well, we spoke English initially, of course, on the plane. But he said, what's your accent? And I said, what's your accent? And he said he came from the Baltics. And I said, which one? And he said, the middle one. So this is Misha being kind of not incredibly forthcoming. And so I was kind of irritated by that. So I said, come on, look, I'm a Soviet historian. I know which the middle one. Just say Latvia. And he then switched to Russian, because Russian was one of his languages, not a major language, but it was a language of his. He switched to Russian. And as I've said about my Russian, sometimes I switch into being a real person in Russian. And that's what happened.
And did that modulating between languages continue through the decade that you were together?
No, we didn't speak Russian to each other except when we were with Russians. I mean, it was, as I say, it wasn't a major language of Misha. My Russian is better than his. He was brought up multilingual, so no problem to him which language. But German was really his first language, though he didn't want to say that, but it was so. German, Latvian, Russian, you know, English, French, and so on. So, yeah, no, so we spoke English. And I tried to learn German. You see, that's the story of my life, trying to learn German, right? It started back in university. And then with Misha, I tried to learn it again. I went to Goethe Institute and so on. I never really got it good enough.
Sheila, obviously 1989, a critical year in the history of the Soviet Union. What did you make of it as a historian at the time? And how do you look back on 1989 and its significance now?
Well, it was an extraordinary thing to live through. And some people, especially Westerners, but some Russians that I knew, some people thought basically this is a revolution. In other words, things are really going to change and for the better. Finally, you know, we're going to have a sort of purified form of socialism or whatever. I don't think I ever had any such thoughts. I'm not an optimistic person in a way. Probably I always thought this will end in tears one way or the other, but it didn't really matter because it was so exciting as it was going on. And one of the things that made it so exciting is that the way people behaved in the society, or at any rate in the Moscow that I and the other cities that I knew, changed. Soviet people had always been, well, I was describing their friendship groups. They'd always been open and supportive within friendship groups, but not outside them, but wary of the people who are not in. That changed in perestroika. So you would meet somebody for the first time. I mean, let's say you're a Russian in perestroika and you're interviewing. I mean, we do this interview. So we've only just met. Well, at the end, it will be face-to-face being, you know, pre-tech kind of age. At the end, in perestroika, you would be likely to sit down with that journalist who would then tell the story of their life and then probably ask you home. And this immediate sort of direct emotional contact, that was what I noted. That was what's really struck me as a participant.
Right. So the openness in the word perestroika actually flowed down to interpersonal relations at the time.
No, I suppose what was most obvious was that people were saying things in public they hadn't been allowed to say. And that was, of course, interesting, especially for a historian. I mean, you had to read the papers. You had to spend hours reading the papers and the journals every day because there'd be some new revelation. So that was exciting, for sure. The political changes, well, I guess I shared the view of the Chinese that it would have been a good thing to start with the economy, not with politics. In other words, improve people's lives economically and then ask him to criticize everything. Now, that's not what Gorbachev did. He thought, first of all, we have to have open discussion so we can decide how to reform the economy. But the result was that things got tougher and tougher economically, and people are allowed to say anything critical they like. And so they did. And that was one of the ways in which things spun out of control.
Sheila, of course, you are the doyenne of Soviet history, but you now also describe yourself as a historian of migration, and your personal history is marked by quite a number of migrations as well. I wonder if you could chart those personal migrations out for us and perhaps reflect on which of your many migrations was the most challenging.
Yeah, well, that's certainly the fact that I myself have been a migrant back and forth. I'm sure that I had to do with why I, on the verge of coming back to Australia again after 50 years away, that was why I developed that theme of migration. So my first one, I leave in 64 and I go to Oxford and then I go on to Moscow. And it turns out that the Moscow bit is the bit that matters. Then I, after about 8 years based in Britain, but often in the Soviet Union, I go to America. That was initially accident. I wasn't looking to go to America. It was, of course, a central place in my field in Soviet studies, but I thought of it as very Cold War, which it was. By chance, a one-year fill-in job opened up in Austin, Texas. And the money was incredible, and I was on a postdoc at that point in Britain. And so I thought, why not go? It's so such a strange thing that they're asking me to do, but they paid me so much money for it in my terms then. And so I went, and then I spent the year in Austin. That was very interesting. But I thought, I need to go to New York, to a more central place. And so I got myself a fellowship at Columbia. Then I stayed there and everything is fine, especially, well, everything is ultimately fine, especially the 90s when Misha and I are living in Washington and I'm commuting to Chicago and everything is great. That's what my 1989 book is sort of about. Then in 1999, Misha dies. He was 20 years older than me, but we didn't expect it, but still. He dies, and I then sort of contemplate, do I want to spend the rest of my life in the U.S.? And very strongly came the answer, no, even though my job at University of Chicago was the ideal job. So I decided that I'd go somewhere. It was not actually clear to me where. I'd spent a year in Germany, this German theme again, and I even thought about that. You could buy very cheap apartments in Berlin then. And I thought about Britain, but no. So then I thought Sydney, Melbourne, Canberra, and I looked at all of them and I ended up with Sydney. That took me 13 years to come back. But of course, that was another migration. And I think, I don't know which was the hardest. Perhaps the first one was really the hardest, but coming back to Sydney was actually easier for me than moving back 10 years later to Melbourne. There's something about coming back to your hometown that is very challenging. Anyway, but I did it in whatever it was. Just after the pandemic, I came down to Melbourne.
And across those decades, Sheila, was there one or several places that in your heart you felt was home?
Well, yes, if you're allowed to have multiple homes. In other words, there are about six cities probably in the world that I fly into and I think something like coming home. Or I kind of think my place, coming back to my place. So Berlin is one of those. Moscow is one of those, not that I'll ever be flying in there again. Melbourne and Sydney are both. London is there with a very big question mark. And Paris, Misha had that apartment in Paris, so we spent quite a lot of time there in the 90s. So that's another of those places. So all of these places, when I go back to them, there are aspects of feeling I'm coming home, but none of them has the exclusive claim on that, I would say.
And you said that you will never go to Moscow again. Why is that?
Well, it's a combination of the war and my age. In other words, it's hard to go to Moscow. The Australian government, Australian universities, Australian foundations, they make it hard. They don't want you to go. The Russians, up to about a year or so ago, would have let you go. But within the profession of people who work on Russia and the Soviet Union, there is a very strong objection to anybody going, because that is held to indicate support for the war, which in my case, it would not be doing. I don't really approve of boycotting places on those grounds, but that boycott is a serious one. And yeah, I could have challenged it, but I didn't. And there comes the second thing's age. I mean, okay, I'm still doing my two or three international trips per year, but at 80, almost 85, you know, for how long? And so that's why I say I think I won't be seeing Moscow again.
And 1989 is not just the year that you've chosen as the year that made you, but also the year that you've chosen for your next book, Sheila.
Yes, it's my Misha memoir, but also my Perestroika memoir. And I think it is called 1989, but its title keeps changing. 1989 was its original title, but then I got worried about Taylor Swift and I changed it. But now I think maybe people have forgotten about her. So anyway, so maybe I go back to it. But it is, you know, this is the sort of annus mirabilis, basically, for me. When I meet Misha and the Soviet Union, which is where I work and have close ties, is in a state of extraordinarily rapid and unpredictable and unpredicted upheaval.
And it seems fitting that we should finish with a piece of music. And as you mentioned, Sheila, that takes us right back to your initial thesis about music in the Soviet Union. It has been a great pleasure speaking with you, Sheila. Thank you so much for joining us on The Year That Made Me. And what have you chosen for us to listen to go out with, and why?
Well, it's a Shostakovich waltz that maybe Shostakovich didn't write, but it's terrific anyway. Some Soviets wrote it, some people in his circle. I particularly like it because I still play the violin. I went back after Misha died to playing the violin. So I performed it recently in a quartet. So that's why it came to my mind. But anyway, I love it, and I hope your listeners love it too.
Well, we're very much looking forward to hearing it, with only a slight tinge of regret that we're not hearing the Sheila Fitzpatrick rendition.
Thank you.
Find more great ABC RN stories that take you beyond the headlines on the ABC Listen app.